You know, Sigmund Freud used to talk about women being envious of men. He was famous for that. I think it might be kind of opposite with me. I'm very jealous of women because they can have babies. That's a really big deal, you know. Like, if I were God, I would have had men have the babies. Like, I got this, honey. You know, don't worry. I'll do this. And then we could still turn the babies over to the women. Like, here, take care of this, and I'm going to go to war. Or take care of this baby, and I'm going to go farm. Whatever. We could still turn them over. But it's like, you know, it's a really big deal if you could have a baby. And let's talk about building really big deals. The seven wonders of the ancient world. I love this topic because, you know, I like building stuff. And there's the Colossus of Rhodes. And as you can see in the picture there, the ships would actually sail under him. He was so huge. And it took 12 years to build and design it by this guy named Carys. And 300 years before Christ, all this was being done. 98 feet tall, made out of stone and iron and bronze at the entrance of the harbor. But an earthquake broke it at the knees and it fell down. Only lasted 54 years. Like, too bad. Then there's the lighthouse at Alexandria. It was designed and built by Sostratus. And this is 200 years before Christ. 400 feet tall. It would light up the entire harbor at Alexandria, Egypt. And it had a great furnace on the top that provided the light. And once again, earthquakes took it down. It's gone. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Again, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. How wonderful was this? A 400-foot high mountain with a screw irrigation system. A water screw would carry water up to the top of the mountain continuously, and the water would run down. And Nebuchadnezzar built this 600 years before Christ. It was a paradise in the Iraqi desert, and it had full-grown trees on it and a variety of plant life. It was wonderful, but somehow it got destroyed, and we don't even know precisely where it was now. It's gone. Well, the Statue of Zeus. Quite an architectural marvel. Built at Olympia for the Olympic Games in Greece, 400 years before Christ, 42 feet tall, made out of ivory and gold. It got reduced now, just a pile of rocks and debris, and all the precious metals are gone. Then there was the mausoleum of Mausolus. Four sculptors carved each of the four walls, each one taking a wall. 350 years before Christ, 150 feet tall, but once again, destroyed by earthquakes over the year, it's gone. The Temple of Diana, what a structure. This thing was 40 feet tall, bigger than a football field, took up an acre of ground all by itself, and it was built at Ephesus, famous city of the Bible lands. It was destroyed by fire in 356 BC, it's gone. There is one pillar post that's been glued together so you can see where it was. Six out of seven of these ancient wonders are all gone. The great pyramids of Egypt, of course, are still there. But six out of seven are gone. And we're reminded that while all of these great structures are gone, the child you mothers bring into this world will live forever. They'll never be gone. You've brought forth an eternal child, which is just amazing when you think about it. It will never be gone. This child lives on and on. And I always think about the tremendous thing that giving birth is. You know, when a mother cries out in pain during childbirth, it's because she's working. She's bringing forth something amazing. She's building something grand, and it's a baby, and the baby has an eternal soul that goes on and on. So you think, I wonder why she's crying like that. It's because she's working, she's building, she's bringing forth something grand. And when tears come later in life, whether they come from just sentimental joy or from some sort of big celebration or from sorrow, why is the mother crying now? It's because her dreams are being forged and sometimes reforged and twisted in the fires of human experience, and so they cry. And it's a big thing. Mothers are doing a big thing, a great work. And I am jealous of you women because you're doing something that I could never do. It's a big deal. I think if God wanted to say something important to women, he would do it by making them able to give birth when a male cannot. I mean, that is saying something. That's still giving room for males to be the providers, the protectors, the leaders of their home. But it is also saying something for the women, because they and only they can do this grand thing. It is like a super compliment. It is a credit to your species, women, that you're doing this. And I hope you never think that God is just a guy God. He's a God for women too. And you have a huge vote of confidence from God when he made you the child bearers. It's huge. I want to talk today about mothers being the builders and the dreamers. And I want to give you three examples from Scripture that mean a lot to me. And I hope they'll mean something to you as well. And by the way, if you're a man listening, you are in some ways like women in that you're taking care of people and taking care of them in the sense of nurturing and nursing them and being with them when they're sick and when they need you and all of those things. So there definitely is some crossover for all of the men. And I hope you won't tune me out if you're a male. Also, if you're a female and you're not a mother, either by choice or your stage of life or whatever, if you're not a mother, I hope you won't tune me out, because the truth is so much of what we're talking about today crosses over to every human being who wants to serve the Lord. So we want to talk especially, though, about those creatures amongst us, those women who have actually given birth. It's quite a thing. We're going to find that the mothers are builders and dreamers, and they have to make do in imperfect conditions like Eunice did. And they're going to make do in imperfect conditions with the best possible dreams, like Salome had, and with an eye on the future, like Ruth had. And this Mother's Day, I hope you ladies who have given birth, I hope you'll remember that you are like Eunice, like Salome, and like Ruth in very, very wonderful ways. All right, so here's Eunice's story. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 3. We pick up on the story of her son, Timothy, and so here's how it sounds. I thank God, whom I serve for my forefathers, says the Apostle Paul, with pure conscience, that without ceasing, I have remembrance of you, Timothy, in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see you, being mindful of your tears, that I may be filled with joy when I call to remember the unfeigned faith that is in you, which resided first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded in you also. And I am focusing on that term, unfeigned faith. We don't use the word feign anymore very often, but it means to pretend, to fake out. And so in Greek, this is actually an hypokritos. You can hear the word hypocrite in there. You have an unhypocrite faith. This is an unpretended faith. You are the real deal. And your grandmother Lois was the real deal, Timothy, and your mother Eunice was the real deal, and I am persuaded that you're the real deal. So we have a really high compliment to Eunice, Timothy's mother, and of course Lois as well. Now in Timothy's story, again in Acts chapter 16 verse 1, this is the second time Paul has come through this area, and it says this time, second time through, he came to Lystra, and a certain disciple was there named Timothy. The disciple is there because Paul went through previously and Timothy became a Christian. All right, so the second time through, there's a Christian there from last time whose name is Timothy or Timotheus, the son of a certain woman who was a Jewess and believed, but his father was a Greek. Paul wished to have him go with him. Timothy's going to come with him. And he took and he circumcised him because of the Jews which were in those quarters, for they knew all that his father was a Greek. All right, so that's Timothy's situation. When you put these two passages together, you realize that something really, really bad happened in this home. and in some sense was still happening. We don't know exactly what's going on, but here are the possibilities. How in the world did Eunice end up married to a Greek man who was not a convert to Judaism? I mean, if he were a convert to Judaism, there's no problem. That happened all the time in the first century. But he is not a convert to Judaism. You can tell he is not a convert to Judaism because he wouldn't even have his own son circumcised, which is a really big deal in Judaism. And as long as Timothy was in his house, he was not circumcised and did not get circumcised until a young man. I mean, he could have been 14 because, you know, bar mitzvah, I am a man. Could have been that age when he left with Paul. Or more likely, he was, you know, 20. And so this father never did come around to the Jewish faith. Never did. All right, now, how in the world did Eunice, who was complimented by Paul as having an unpretended, unhypocritical faith, how did she end up with that guy? Possibilities. One, maybe Eunice's dad is the bad guy here. Perhaps a lapsed Jew, and he says, Eunice, you're going to marry this Gentile guy because he can provide for you, so you're going to. And Lois and Eunice, who have unfeigned faith in those days, say, no, no, no. Lois telling her husband, no, 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 don't make this happen. Eunice pleading, no, daddy, I don't want to marry a Gentile man. I don't want to. He doesn't even believe like we believe. Don't make me marry him. And maybe he's the bad guy and he forces it. Well, if he did, then Eunice is going to have a lot to work through against resenting her father for forcing her into a marriage she didn't want to be in. Or, additionally, she has a lot to work through with her husband that she never wanted to marry. I mean, something went really bad here, and we don't know why. Another possibility. Maybe Eunice's dad and mom were both bad guys. Remember, the marriages are, for the most part, arranged in the first century, both in the Greek culture and in the Jewish culture. Even today, ultra-Orthodox Jewish people have matchmakers like, you know, Fiddler on the Roof. And you have a choice about who you can marry as far as you can choose any one of these three men, dear. And you can date them for hours before you decide. So even to this day, that happens. Now, it doesn't happen very often. But if you go back to the first century, that was, you know, the expectation. All right, so maybe Eunice's dad and mom are both the bad guys here, and they forced Eunice into a marriage working together, and Eunice said, no, mommy and daddy, I don't want to marry this guy, but mom and dad are lapsed Jews, and so they force her to do it, and now she has to keep from resenting both mom and dad and resenting her husband that she never wanted to marry. And if that's the case, then Lois came around so that she has an unfeigned faith. So if that's what happened, then Lois lapsed and came back around sometime before Timothy came along. The third possibility. By the way, none of these possibilities are good, right? Third possibility. Eunice's dad and Eunice were against Lois. Maybe Eunice's dad and Eunice are lapsed Jews. And they think, well, I'm going to marry this Gentile guy. And Lois, with her unfeigned faith in those days, is saying, no, daughter, just wait. God will bring along a nice Jewish man. And dad and Eunice are against Lois and say, no, no, the daughter wants to marry this Gentile guy and he's going to. So maybe that's what's going on. In that case, you can just imagine now Lois resents her husband for forcing this, for encouraging this. She has to work through this with her daughter who's lapsed and decided to do this crazy thing. And she has a lot to work through. In any case, this is not good. Maybe Eunice all by herself was the bad guy. Maybe mom and dad are pleading with her, Eunice, do not haul off and marry this Gentile guy. It's not a good match. And she says, no, mom and dad, I'm going to. I don't care what you say. I'm wayward and I'm not going to listen. I'm defying your wishes. In that case, now mom and dad have a lot to work through with Eunice. There's been strain between Eunice and mom and dad. And what are they going to think about the son-in-law? I mean, it's just a big mess. Last of all, Maybe the whole family of Eunice is lapsed, wayward in their Jewishness, and they were all wayward. And then two, Lois and Eunice, came back to an unfeigned faith. No matter what the circumstances are, this is not good. There is no way a faithful Jewish person who's going to marry a Gentile pagan in the first century without fireworks. There is no way that's going to happen. And so that is in Eunice's past. Well, we said something big must have happened, but the truth is it was still happening all through the years. So Timothy's dad never did come to faith, right? Because Timothy never was circumcised. And nobody says he has an unfeigned faith. So he never did come around, as far as the biblical narrative is concerned. I wouldn't be surprised if we see him in heaven, but that would be after the biblical narrative that he came to Christ. But anyway, during all of Timothy's growing up years, we have a problem. Mother has an unfeigned faith and dad is a pagan. That's the problem. Then either Lois or Eunice or both had a drastic change of heart by the time Timothy came along. Whatever caused this Gentile thing to happen, there was a change of heart so that when Timothy comes along, they name him Timotheus. Timao, I honor. Theos, God, I honor God. Of course, that works for paganism too, which is why a pagan father might not have resisted. But we would think that Eunice is choosing the name because she wants to rally back after whatever bad thing happened that made her marry this Gentile guy. No matter what, all through Timothy's years, there has to be a lot of flying under the radar and a lot of ignoring the elephant in the living room because we have a pagan Gentile dad who's never been converted to the Jewish faith, and we have a mother with unfeigned faith and a grandmother with unfeigned faith, and now a son with unfeigned faith, all trying to work everything out in the same household. And for poor Timothy, he had to be the half-breed Jewish boy who was never circumcised. That is not going to go over well in the Jewish quarter of the city. So he has deficits socially to overcome, and it wouldn't be comfortable. So he says, something really bad happened. We don't know what happened, but something really bad happened, and it was still happening every single day in Timothy's childhood. In other words, making do in imperfect conditions. For Eunice to put together what was a nice life for Timothy and to teach him the Jewishness that became the foundation for his Christian faith when he finally understood the gospel, for that to happen, there had to be a lot of overcoming in imperfect conditions. And the truth is, that's the way it is for all moms. If you're a mother today, I can absolutely promise you that the world is a hard place. But you have to sail with the wind God gives you. And there's nothing you can do about that. Life is hard. And you probably wouldn't choose for certain things to be the way they are. But you have to sail with the wind God gives you. All the moms I know will fall into one of these categories, all of them. Either stressful schedules, health problems in your family, and almost every mom I know has something like this that they're working through with their children, with their parents, with themselves. Financial hardships, mistakes from the past that still affect your life. Sometimes you think, yeah, I did this when I was young, like maybe Eunice did when she was young or whatever was going on there, and it still affects my life to this day. I wish it didn't, but it does. Your husband's faults or his absence. You can imagine that Eunice has wishes for her husband, and evidently they don't come to pass, at least not in the biblical narrative. Your husband's faults, you know, some of you poor women have really married duds, you know. Think of my poor wife. Your child's emotional unwellness or learning deficits or defiance. It's so hard to raise children. Your societal and political environment. I mean, what if you were raising a child in sub-Saharan Africa or in North Korea? But even without that, you're raising children in the public school system or with neighbors that are mean or with your own situation at work, which is barely tolerable. You have political, economic, and societal things going on. It's hard to raise children. Children are like this crazy mix, don't you think, of irrational thoughts. Like, why are you doing this? And iron wills. Like, why are you doing this? And you're so stubborn. I just can't believe that you're thinking this way and you're so stuck. And then snowflake emotions. It's sort of like an egg. But imagine an egg that was as hard as a golf ball. And you have to, you know, crack this thing open so that you can have breakfast. And you're just wailing at it and wailing at it to crack it open. And then finally, it just splatters out. It's like these kids are absolutely bulletproof. My father used to say, the only language you boys understand is a spanking. The only language you understand is brute force. You know, that's the only thing you understand. Well, I don't know if that's totally true, but because my wife says I have like no iron will anymore. I just do everything that she wants. So I really don't know what my dad was getting at there. But irrational thoughts, like, you know, all kinds of crazy, stuck and stubborn and iron. And then you do it just a little bit too wrong, and they spill out. Like, oh, brother. You know, you can't, either you're iron or you're mush, but you can't be both. But children are both. We ask the question all the time, who is this kid? Like, why is he acting this way? And sometimes they ask that about our parents. I read sometime back about a mother who finally got the kids to bed, you know, which is like World War III every time. Finally get the kids to bed, a little me time, as the mothers call it. And so she's wearing her crazy-looking pajamas. Nobody's around. She's wearing her crazy-looking pajamas. And she's washed her hair. Her hair is wet. You know, she's trying to have a little calm before bed. And she hears her boys in there cutting up. And they're getting rowdier and rowdier. And so finally, in exasperation, she wraps a towel around her head like a turban, and she goes into their dark room, and she reads them the riot act and rebukes them, gets them separated in their normal beds and tells them to be quiet. And she leaves the room, and as she closes the door, she hears her three-year-old son say, "Who was that?" It's like children are so hard to raise. Like, can you not just go to bed? I mean, can we not just do anything simply? Children are hard. And I love what Richard Baxter says. He says, imperfect or none must be your service here. You always wonder, am I doing it just right? I mean, why is it this craziness in our house? Am I doing it just right? And probably you're making mistakes. But, you know, nobody is perfect. And your choice for motherhood is the same as your choice for everything else in life. You can do it imperfectly or you can just not be a mother. But there's no such thing as a perfect mother, right? So imperfect or none, those are your choices. Perfection is not an option. And so you make do in imperfect conditions. And it doesn't always turn out as you might hope. So, of course, we have a really happy ending with Timothy, right? But remember, Eunice also would have had dreams and prayers for her husband. And evidently, those did not turn out the way she had dreamed and hoped. So there's not always anything you can do about it. And I like to remind you that making do in imperfect conditions sometimes means things don't turn out as you prefer. God was the perfect parent, and he couldn't keep Adam from making catastrophic choices. So just because your children don't turn out the way you want them, that doesn't mean it's your fault. The prodigal son's father was evidently an ideal father, and he couldn't keep the prodigal son from being bad, making catastrophic choices. Hezekiah, in some ways, the best king that the Israelites ever had. He didn't do any of the big wrongdoings of David and Solomon. He was like the best Jewish king ever. And he overcame his own father, Ahaz, who was bad. And Hezekiah rallied back and he put it together. And you think, well, great, he's a wonderful parent. Look at Hezekiah. And then Hezekiah gives birth to Manasseh, who becomes king. And Manasseh is the worst king Israel ever had, worse than Ahab. Manasseh is the worst. So finally, Hezekiah, a bright spot in the royal family. And as good as he was, he couldn't keep Manasseh from making catastrophic choices, becoming the worst king. So really the point is your personal unfeigned faith. You just have to be that. And as far as what your kids do, you can't control that. A mother's job is like hanging paintings in a gallery of your children's nursery. And what you're doing is you're going in that nursery and you're picking the paintings and you hang them on the wall so that when your child is grown, he has imprinted in his memory the paintings you put on his nursery wall. And when things are dark and confusing and crazy and tempting, the hope is he'll have these paintings burned into his memory because you put them there. You can't make him do anything. Just hang the pictures in the nursery. And that's what you're doing. Your success as a mom, as a woman, as a person is not in how your children turn out. It is in your personal, unpretended, unhypocritical faith. And that's what you got to do. You know her, right? Most of us refer to her as Rosie the Riveter. And in World War II, we were trying to encourage women to help with the war effort because we needed everybody. And the men weren't able to be in the factories if they're at the war, right? So the women had to go to the factories. And Rosie the Riveter was actually first posted at Westinghouse. And they didn't call her Rosie. That came along later. But in the song, Rosie the Riveter, popular song in the 40s, they said that she has a boyfriend who's a Marine. And while he's out saving her in the war, she's in the factory saving him by building what he needs to succeed. She's saving her soldier in the song, her Marine. She's pretty, she's determined, and she's saving her soldier. That's what mothers are doing. You're pretty, you're determined, and you're saving your kids. You're doing the best you can. You can't do it all, but you're doing the best you can in imperfect wartime conditions. That's what Eunice had to do. So keep believing and keep building because your story isn't finished yet. Mothers are builders and dreamers, making do in imperfect conditions like Eunice and with the best possible dreams like Salome. Salome is the mother for James and John. We know what her dreams are because they're told to us in Matthew 20:20. Then the mother of Zebedee's children came to him, Jesus, with her sons, James and John, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And Jesus said to her, "What do you wish?" And she said to him, "Grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on your right hand and the other on the left, in your kingdom." That's her dream. Now, you remember that caused quite a disturbance with the other disciples. Said, who are they to think that they can be the Lord's favored ones, highest ranking, nearest to him in his royal administration? Who are they? Caused a stir. And even now we think, yeah, you know, that was probably bad form. It was bad form in several ways, but the dream is good. You know, it's never wrong for you to wish for the closest possible nearness to the Savior for yourself. And for his special favor for yourself, that's never wrong. The Lord wants us to wish to be near him. Draw near to him and he'll draw near to you. He wants you to wish for that. That's never wrong. And it wasn't wrong for Salome. And it's not wrong for you to wish that for your children either. As a matter of fact, that's exactly the very best wish you can have. That's the dream. That is the best possible dream. You never know how this idea started. We know that it became a shared dream. Because it wasn't just Salome who approached Jesus that day. According to Mark's gospel, James and John are the representative speakers. They all were participating in the dialogue. So James and John came to him, not just Salome. James and John came to him saying, "Master, we wish that you should do for us whatever we shall desire." And he said to them, "Well, what do you wish that I should do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand, the other on your left in your glory." So is it Salome who's asking, or is it the boys who are asking? The answer is both. All are asking. And this means that it's a shared dream. Now, you have to think that it started in the heart of Salome. Because boys don't usually think, hey, my brother and I, because of sibling rivalry, you know, my brother and I are going to sit 1 and 2. They think I am going to be number 1, and they really don't care very much about number 2. But a mother would. A mother would definitely say, wouldn't it be nice if my 2 boys were the highest ranking people in the new royal kingdom of Jesus? Wouldn't that be nice? See, that sounds like a mother's dream, not like a sibling rivalry dream, right? And I wouldn't be surprised if it all started in Salome's heart. We don't know for sure. We know it was her dream, that it was a shared dream, but we don't know who started it. But I'm guessing it was Salome. And that's the very best thing you could ever wish for anybody. The song from the 1980s, I suppose. I could wish you joy and peace to last a whole life long. And I could wish you sunshine or a cheerful little song. Or wish you all the happiness that this life could bring. But I wish you Jesus more than anything. I always think about that with my own kids. Teresa and I pray for our kids at dinner time every evening. And we always say something like this: Lord, please help our kids to put you first. Please help our kids to love you, to be good, not just good at something, but good children and grandkids. For us, we have 5 big ones and 5 little ones. We pray for the 5 bigs and the 5 littles all the same. Lord, please make them good. I wish you Jesus more than anything, and that's a really good dream. Mothers are builders and dreamers. They have to make do in imperfect conditions, like Eunice, and they do it with the best possible dreams, like Salome, and they do it with an eye on the future, like Ruth. Ruth's story is so great, right? In Ruth chapter 4, Boaz said to all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, I have purchased Ruth the Moabite to be my wife." Now, that's a little bit like Eunice's story. There is a problem. Something bad has happened here. And you know what the badness is. We have Ruth being from the cursed tribe of Moab. The Moabites were not appreciated. They were frequent enemies of Israel, and they were cursed by God from time immemorial. So she has a strike against her. Furthermore, her husband has died and she has no visible means of support now. So now here is Boaz, a wonderful, wealthy Jewish man, saying, "I want to marry her." I mean, it's a great story. Moreover, verse 10 says, "I've purchased Ruth the Moabite to be my wife." And all the people said, "We are witnesses. The Lord make the woman that has come into your house like Rachel and Leah, who built the house of Israel." Rachel and Leah had the 12 tribes of Israel. From the 12 tribes, we get the entire population of Israel. And the blessing is, may you and your new wife make a new nation, just like Rachel and Leah. The Lord make the woman that has come into your house like Rachel, like Leah, who built the house of Israel. And let your house be like the house of Phares, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because all this is happening in Judah. So of the 12 tribes, especially Judah, and Tamar started that from the seed which the Lord shall give you through this young woman. We just hope that your tribe will increase because of this. Now, you have to understand, this is Ruth's wedding day, and it wasn't a proper wedding, right? It's all happening like a negotiation in public with the elders at the gates of the city. And Boaz says, with a crowd of people watching, okay, everybody gets it, right? I paid money for the entire estate of Ruth's mother-in-law. So now that whole property is mine. And furthermore, Ruth is going to marry me. Like, everybody gets it, right? Everybody says, okay, yep, you're married, beginning right now. So it's not like a normal wedding. We get it. In front of everybody, in front of all of these witnesses, you are married, you and Ruth. You're married. All right, so this is her wedding day. And the blessing is, oh, we hope that you have a whole tribe. That's wedding day. she got married and she's tribal all at the same time. And then this is the close of the book of Ruth. So Boaz took Ruth. She was his wife. And the Lord gave her conception and she bore a son. And Naomi took the child and became a nurse to it. Naomi is the grandmother. So we have a grandmother thing going on here. And they called his name Obed. He's the father of Jesse, the father of David. So Boaz, Ruth's husband, brought forth Obed. And Obed brought forth Jesse. And Jesse brought forth David. So Ruth is David's grandmother. And that's the end. You know, you would think there would be like, they all lived happily ever after or something like that. But that is literally the end of the book of Ruth. So to me, it sounds like this. Ruth brought forth Obed, Jesse, and David. The end. I was like, and you know what that means. Or as the girls say it, so there's that. I think that's a female saying. I don't hear men say that very often. So there's that. I think girls made it up and girls repeat it and popularize it. So there's that. And that's how the book of Ruth ends. It's just like, David, hello. Well, that is fraught, filled, pregnant with significance. So here's what it is. An eye on the future. Her wedding day. May the Lord make the woman that has come into your house like Rachel and like Leah who built the house of Israel. And Boaz brought forth Obed and Jesse and David. It's like on her wedding day, we're already talking about the future. And that's what it means to be a mother. You are suddenly building the future. On the day you're married, you're building the future. The special secret of Ruth, you know, the book of Ruth, is the same as the special secret that goes on with every mother. Once you've had a baby, do you see what's happening there? Once you've had a baby, the whole future becomes possible. You know, it's like you could say, I'm a fortune teller. I'm a prophetess. I have seen the future because I'm a mother. I'm a mother. I know the future. Now, of course, you don't absolutely know the future, but you know that there is a future. Even, by the way, if the child dies in infancy, the child doesn't cease to exist, and there's a heavenly everlasting future. I'm a mother. I have seen the future. And Ruth glimpsed something of this from the first day of her marriage. That's just extraordinary. Once you bring a baby into this world, you have set off the ripples in the pond, and incalculable cosmic sequence of events. And when you're a grandmother, you see a little bit more of it because you're starting to say, okay, well, when I was young, I had this baby, and then I'm starting to see more and another generation, and I see the bent, the propensity of this grandchild. And so you're starting to see more of the future. But you didn't really know that when you were 20-something and had your first baby. But you're starting to see it a little more as a grandmother. But no mother ever lives long enough to see it all. When Alexander Graham Bell, you know, invented the telephone and it really worked, and he talked to his friend Watson and others, it was amazing. Like, you know, what is this going to be in the future? And inventors often land back on this term, what has God wrought? Which comes from the book of Numbers or Deuteronomy. I can't remember, but maybe Numbers. What has God wrought? Wrought means worked. What has God worked? Look it. We have a baby here. This is a wonder. And it goes on and on and on, longer than the seven wonders of the ancient world. This is a wonder. What has God wrought? What has he done? So mothers are the builders and dreamers among us. They have to make do in imperfect conditions like Eunice did, and they have to do it with the best possible dreams to wish them Jesus, like Salome did, and with an eye on the future, like Ruth. Like from the day you're married, from the day you have a baby, you've changed the course of human history. It's amazing. So I'm going to close with this illustration from John William Smith. I think about this all the time. It tends to be what I think about, especially on Mother's Day. And he was watching a Dallas area girls regional cross-country competition. It was a two-mile race. He didn't have anybody there. He just happened to be with friends who had somebody competing. So as a friend of a friend kind of a thing, he's there watching. So he doesn't have anybody in particular to cheer for. So he's just observing the others who are cheering for their daughters. He focused on this very animated 40-something mom who was in dress shoes and a skirt, carrying her purse. And apparently she'd come from work or something like that, and her daughter was competing. And this woman was cheering for Tammy. Now you have to picture that there are between 80 and 100 runners, and all of them have people cheering for them. So there are hundreds of people cheering toward the end of the race. And this mother, 40-something, has determined that she wants her daughter to hear her when the time comes. And so she's running. The daughter is running. And mom is a little ways down the course. And she's cheering, saying, "Run, Tammy, run." Well, Tammy is totally exhausted. This is the end of the race. Her muscles are probably cramping. She probably feels a little sick. She's worn out. She could probably faint. And somehow this 40-something woman in her dress clothes makes her voice heard. "Run, Tammy, run." And Tammy heard her. So they said when Tammy heard her mom, there's just like new life came into her. And she kind of straightened up and she just looked a little stronger. And for the last 100 yards, this woman carrying a purse in dress shoes and a skirt is trotting along saying, "Run, Tammy, run." And they finally get to the end together and they hug. And because Tammy is so tired and they're just kind of being silly, they fell down and they started crying together. And then they started laughing together. And it was the greatest thing. John William Smith said, it was like a portrait of life. And here's what he said. "I thought of my own children and the race of life they are running, a different and far more important race. I'm a spectator in that race also. I have helped them to train. I have pleaded, instructed, threatened, punished, prayed, praised, laughed, and cried, but now the gun is up and their race has begun and I am a spectator. My heart is bursting, always whispering in a voice they cannot hear, 'Run, children, run.'" So, if you had a choice, if I had a choice, and the Lord doesn't give me that choice, he gives you the choice, ladies. If you had a choice between building one of the 7 wonders of the world or being a mother, I hope you would choose to be a mother because your work will last a lot longer and it's much more important. All of you who are mothers are wonderful. You're doing a great thing. And I'd like to close the service today by praying for you. Father God, as these mothers are emotionally frayed because they spend most of their energy in their prime years trying to keep bad things from happening to their children and the people they love, and it doesn't work very well. So as they are emotionally frayed today on this Mother's Day, I pray that you will also help them to be encouraged because they're doing a great thing in imperfect conditions, with the highest possible dreams and with the future in their eye. And we pray that they'll be able to see just a little bit of the great work they're doing today on this Mother's Day. In Jesus' name, amen.